good to go and we can talk about your book and about copying. Is that okay?
Sure.
All right, great. Well, so Marcus, you write that you began thinking about copies and copying in a kind of unusual place, Space Mountain at Disney World.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a kind of backstory to that, I guess, that, I mean, first of all, some great French philosophers had written about Disneyland and Disney World as a kind of palace of copying. But yeah, I was studying with a Tibetan Buddhist teacher in the early 2000s, and one of his favorite metaphors for how to meditate was that you should go and go to places like Disney World and go on rides that scare you, and that when you find yourself on these rides, that's when you should meditate.
Are you saying you went to Disney World because your Tibetan Buddhist teacher told you to?
Yeah, I mean, I think he'd gone to Disneyland or Disney World in Paris, and he'd really liked these kind of crazy rides. And he said, well, meditating is, in a way, it's like being thrown into space without any ground underneath you. So you should practice that way and get used to it.
Okay, so you're in Disney World because of your Tibetan Buddhist teacher, but you're meditating on something some French philosophers said?
Yeah, because like Jean Baudrillard, the kind of great philosopher of postmodernism, had written this book, Simulations, where he talked about Disney World as a simulation, in other words, as a copy. And he made this kind of very clever one-upsmanship type point that everyone goes to Disneyland or Disney World because they want to go to this hokey place full of copies, and they laugh at how silly it is, and then they walk out of the exit and they think they go back to the real world. But what they don't realize is that when they exit Disney World, they're actually in an even more simulated place than Disney World itself. And that truly the whole of the modern world is a place full of copies. And we imagine that copies only exist in places like Disney World, where, you know, there's a fake Mickey Mouse walking around. And we do that to reassure ourselves that there's a world that isn't full of copies outside of Disney World. But that actually, if you look at it carefully, the copies are everywhere.
What copies? What are all the copies in our real world? I mean, it sounds like you're implying that our entire lives are copies.
Well, he talked about, say, for example, a shopping mall, and the way that, let's say, you go to Disney World, then you go to a shopping mall, or you go to a fast food place on the highway, and, you know, in a certain way, the fast food joint is real. On the other hand, fast food joints are often literally replicas of each other, and they're very carefully designed spaces that actually are produced as copies of each other. And that's true in shopping malls as well.
Shopping malls, Starbucks, airports. Yes, we live in a world of stores and restaurants and cafes that are all copies of each other. I suppose you could say that the McDonald's hamburger you buy is a copy of a hamburger.
Well, okay, but let's push it a little further. Let's say then you go back to your house, you go to your townhouse, maybe your suburban semi-detached house. And, you know, usually if they're built in the last century, those buildings also tend to be produced en masse as copies of each other. And it's actually a very carefully constructed environment that, you know, feels as real as anything, and yet is nonetheless a copy. Mm-hmm. And I think you could go through nearly every aspect of our lives, you know, which we experience as real and in some sense unique and original. And you could show that at almost every point we were in actual fact interacting with copies. And that's what I do in my book then, is I really do try to push it as far as I can. And, you know, even the conversation we're having right now, at every level, the words we're using were learned, they're copies of words. We feel like when we're speaking them for the first time, but they only mean something because other people have used them and because there's a culture of copying, of imitation, that allows us to share a vocabulary, a grammar. And, you know, language itself functions through copying.
You make me think of an experience I have occasionally because I'm a little absent-minded. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but, you know, I'm looking for my car in a parking lot. And first of all, there are a lot of cars that look like mine. And without really thinking, I accidentally get in somebody else's car. And then I look at the stuff in the car and think, wait, those aren't my things. And there's a little moment where you realize that you could be living somebody else's life. Your life doesn't feel quite real anymore.
Yeah, it's a strange moment, right? And it's, you know, mostly it's a moment we prefer not to think about, even though in a way we rely on the fact that our lives are almost identical to other people's lives in order to be functional and to live. And in fact, if our lives are too different from other people's lives, we think that's weird, and we're uncomfortable with people who don't copy, you know, certain basic rules of how to behave, for example.
Sure, to a certain extent, we label them pathological and put them in institutions.
Yeah, exactly. So there's like a very small kind of area where we accept originality, creativity in the strictly defined sense. And yeah, I mean, cars, car parks, definitely are kind of palaces of copying, if you like.
So why is it, do you think, that if we live in a world of copies, the very word copy has mostly negative connotations for us? You know, a copy is by definition not the original. It's not the real thing. It's a fake. You know, a student who copies someone else's work is, we call her a plagiarist. If you hand me a fake $100 bill, I call you a counterfeiter. If one of us copies Apple's latest computer design, Apple will sue the pants off us.
Right, exactly. Although, again, with the student who plagiarizes, on the other hand, most of our students also know that if you want to get an A, you'd better not say anything too original, too. That, in a sense, most teachers expect their students to copy or imitate their points of view. And so, like, a smart student, on the one hand, does do something creative, but also, you know, is capable of tuning into the kind of structures of imitation that teaching and learning involve. So again, there's a kind of fine line between originality and copying there. But I mean, as to your broader question of why do we think copying is wrong, it's a vast question. And on the one hand, if you look at philosophy, you can go all the way back to Plato, who thinks imitation should be banned from the Republic, basically. And even though Plato's philosophy is also in a certain sense a philosophy built around imitation too, but he believes that you should strive to actually experience and seek out the original from which copies are made, and the truth is related to originality in that way. But I think, so we have kind of long histories going all the way back to at least ancient Greece, where there's a kind of hostility towards copying, and we're told that, you know, originality is what matters. But I think today when we learn about copying, we're learning about copying within a particular political environment, an economic environment, where we have things like intellectual property law that predispose us to think in terms of originality being produced by a particular individual who then owns the form of originality that he or she produces. And then the kind of mass of copyists who should pay for the copies that they purchase, but should not be allowed access to copies outside of consuming them. And in fact, industrial culture is a culture of copying. Mass production equals mass production of copies. But one should only have access to those copies if one pays for them.
Are there other cultures that place more value on the act of copying, that don't see it as something to be so hemmed about by laws and politics?
Well, I think it's a subtle question. Certainly in pre-industrial economies, the main way people had access to culture was through copying, and imitation was a kind of skill or practice that people cultivated or learned, and it was understood as such. You know, that if you wanted to learn to paint, you did it through imitating a master. If you were learning a martial art, if you were learning a spiritual practice, you did that through imitation. And in certain cultures, like I'm thinking, for instance, of Indian classical music, where basically no great Indian classical musical performer would ever admit to being original, even when, in fact, they are highly original and they're doing things that no one really ever did before. They would simply say that they're copying the masters that they learnt from. So there's a kind of modesty in other cultures where it's actually more respectable to say that you learnt it from someone else than to say that you came up with it yourself. And for a whole bunch of reasons, in our society, it's kind of the reverse. Like we're supposed to come up with things ourselves, even when in fact most of what we come up with necessarily involves practices of copying other people.
Hmm. You know that phrase people say, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery? Sounds like you think we do not actually believe that.
Well, we only believe it when we feel hurt because we want to hold on to what we think of as our originality. And, you know, in that phrase, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, is the notion that when someone imitates us, we ourselves didn't imitate someone else, and we're the original and they're the copy. And I think it's very hard for most of us, including myself, to actually accept the fact that even the moments where we think that we're being original, we actually owe a lot to other people that came before us. And even though it feels original, in fact, mostly what it is a copy. Hmm.
What impact do you think the glorification of originality has on our emotional lives? Because I think that most of us feel a certain amount of anxiety around the question of whether we're living authentic, really individual lives.
Yeah. I mean, I think it probably causes a lot of suffering, actually. And I think a movie like Adaptation, that Charlie Kaufman movie, is really good on this, that you have this middle-aged guy who wants to be a screenplay writer and keeps wanting to come up with original ideas and can't really do it. And over the course of the movie, he more or less learns adaptation, in other words, how to copy in a kind of honorable way and to accept his place in a world that is functions through copying in a way. And Yeah, I think we live in a culture of free choice, of individuality. We're all supposed to express ourselves in terms of our desires and our identities and come up with something unique, uniquely ours. And maybe in other periods, the pressure to do that wasn't so intense. You know, the people would mostly conform to certain rituals, certain identities. And then their lives would still unfold in their own ways anyway. Like every life would have its own story that would come out in the subtle ways in which, you know, particular repeated patterns played out. You know, birth, life, death, relationships, work, tragedy, pleasure.
Though I think we do appreciate, I mean, that's what we call tradition, right? And
true.
And we also do appreciate that. I mean, we also do value the ways in which we're holding to family or cultural traditions, passing those things on to our children. Don't you think?
I think so. I mean, maybe one of the places that starts to fall apart is in our relationship to the economy and in our relationship to capitalism, where, you know, those forms of tradition are precisely what's kind of broken or put under very high pressure, where we have to compete with other people suddenly and we have to show that we're different from other people, and where, you know, a craftsman or an artisan in previous times would have seen him or herself as part of a tradition. Now, we're always trying to look for some way of breaking with that so that we can say how we're different to those of us around us or even those who came before us.
You write some in the book about something you call industrial folk cultures.
Right.
What do those have to do with copying and a culture of copying?
Well, first of all, as I said before, I think it's good to think of industrial culture in general as a culture of copying, that, you know, we rely on mass production of copies for most of our needs around the globe today. And so, you know, industrialism equals a culture of copying. But then, on the other hand, I think what I'm calling industrial folk cultures is about the way in which particular individuals find their own way of adapting to industrial culture through making copies of industrial products and then radically transforming them in different ways.
For example?
And I think of hip-hop, for example, that hip-hop emerged as a practice of DJing, where DJs would take what were basically dime store records, kind of records that nobody really cared about anymore, and they would play them and cut them up and mix them with other records in such a way that they actually produced something new out of these kind of abandoned copies. And, you know, those old vinyl records, they were products of industrial culture. They're copies, like literally copies. And so rather than trying to be original in the sense of, I don't know, a blues musician or a jazz musician who actually plays their own music, a great hip-hop DJ would actually make something new literally out of the copies and fragments of the recent industrial past. I think a lot of musical subcultures do that. Like they're very, you know, intensely copying things that are around them, but they're doing it in such a way that there's a tiny difference that emerges from the way in which they do it, the way in which they repeat something.
Of course, sometimes copying is an act of deception. I mean, there's a reason that counterfeiting and forgery are illegal and I mean, I imagine as a professor, you don't let your students plagiarize. Or do you?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, my thoughts on plagiarism are somewhat complicated just because when I do encounter a plagiarism case and I have to deal with it, which I do, you know, one of the things I usually tell the students is, look, if you'd done what you did, and usually what students do is they'll go on the internet and instead of writing something out in their own words, they'll cut and paste several quotations from several internet sources and then kind of rework it a little bit and then hand it in. And usually they do a bad job of it, and you can see that it's not really their language. And what I say to the students is, look, if you'd only just put your cuts and pastes in quotations and then tried to use a few words of your own in establishing the link between these quotations, which is basically what you were trying to do anyway, this wouldn't be plagiarism. We just call this citation, and that's something we're encouraging.
So you're saying they just didn't copy well enough?
Exactly. And they didn't copy in a, I guess you would say, an honorable way, where they actually owned up to the fact that they were copying and they participated in a practice of copying that's actually acceptable.
So you pose this really fascinating question in your book. What would or will the world look like when everyone can copy everything freely, when there are enough copies for everyone? So I want to put the question back to you. What do you think? How would that look and what would change?
I don't know. In one way, it's a scenario from a science fiction movie, but even since I wrote the book, things have been changing very rapidly. I mean, for example, the introduction of 3D printers, which is incredible that now, rather than relying on an industrial factory to produce the objects that we need to live, there's actually the possibility of owning a three-dimensional printer that we simply make objects with.
I was thinking about that. You know, instead of going to the store, we'll just print a copy of whatever the product is that we desire.
Yeah. And of course, like, there are great kind of possibilities that this will open up, and terrible ones too. I mean, one of the things people talk about with 3D printers is that everyone will be able to manufacture their own weapons or guns, for example. On the other hand, access to medical tools will suddenly increase. I mean, my own single experience of a 3D printer is having a dental implant that is basically designed on a computer and then using a kind of 3D laser cutter that chops into a porcelain block that a new tooth was produced for me. And I actually watched it being kind of carved out in this strange machine. So I think there's incredible opportunities there and probably incredible dangers. But I think without rethinking what our political and economic system is, and specifically things like how do we work, why do we work, what do we do when we work, there are going to be incredible obstacles to achieving or working with something that technically we're going to be capable of as a global society fairly soon.
What do you mean? What kinds of obstacles?
Well, for example, if you don't have to pay for anything because you can simply make a copy of it at home, what will the function of industry and business be at that point? And, you know, how will issues like intellectual property claims be dealt with at the moment where one has this kind of incredible control just through one's computer at home?
Do you think this is precisely the reason that we are so critical of copying, that we live in a culture in which copying has become easier and easier and easier? Maybe, you know, just as a result, we're more obsessed with and place more value on whatever we consider to be original, not a copy.
But if the basic problem of a global society is how we satisfy basic human needs, and the production of copies becomes so cheap that we can satisfy those needs without bankrupting ourselves as a global society, why wouldn't we embrace this and work towards it as the basis of a happier global society?
So you're saying we have this weird schizophrenic attitude in which our whole culture and economy produces more and more copies and our lives are based on copies, but we judge them all the time.
Yeah, and we don't really have a political and economic system that supports our technical capabilities as makers of copies. And I think you see that with just downloading culture on the internet, that at this point, a lot of people have access to basically any film or recording or image that they want. And yet, basically, we don't have a legal or economic structure that supports that. The question of how people make a living when everyone has totally free access to copies of movies or music is we just don't have answers to those questions. And in some sense, we don't want to answer the questions because we prefer the current situation and we prefer having to go to work, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow. What would the alternative be? Because I'm thinking, I have several friends who are writers and they hate the world in which their work can be downloaded for free or copied illegally, and they don't let their... I have friends who are writers who won't let their children download any music without paying because they think that's somebody else's mother or father who's not getting the royalties that they need to live on.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I have friends who are journalists who are in exactly that situation too. And I don't think we have good answers to that question right now. I mean, I could talk about something like global minimum wages, which some people have talked about. And one can talk about the ways in which different societies have subsidized artists or writers. You know, because, of course, for a journalist or a writer, being able to distribute your writing to anyone in the world who has a computer is also an incredible blessing and an incredible opportunity to participate in a global discussion. The question really is, how does one provide an economic basis for that happening? And it's true, one could simply say, well, one has to go back to the old system because their journalists were getting paid. But, you know, there are also very powerful aspects of digital culture that, you know, we wouldn't want to go back to the print culture that existed before. And
right now,
you know, kids who are growing up right now have grown up almost entirely in a digital culture where their access to culture is so radically expanded that to go back to the world of the 60s or 70s is impossible. Like they literally wouldn't know what the world of print culture even looked like anymore.
Well, and we live now in an age of kind of political transparency on the online that's produced things like the Arab Spring. So, you know, there are very real political reasons we might not want to go back.
Yeah.
But, you know, to your question, then, how are the writers and the artists and the producers of culture supposed to actually make a living anymore?
I honestly don't have an answer, but I don't believe we can actually formulate an answer without addressing copying in a direct way without understanding the way in which our lives are underwritten by continuous practices of copying that we are able to live because we share copies fundamentally, and that our decision of how politically and economically we organize our society in order to share, the different societies historically have made different decisions about how they arrange things, and the new technologies that are now at our disposal also suggest the need to rethink not just intellectual property law, but the relationship between our copying capabilities and the broadest issues of political economy. In other words, how we organize the society we live in.
Marcus, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Many thanks.
Let me just check with Doug and see if there was anything else you want me to ask. I didn't. The one thing I forgot, you had a really interesting bit in your book, Marcus, about Louis Vuitton handbags. I didn't get to that. Doug, do you want that? And do we have time, or is the CBC going to kick us out? Oh, yeah, yeah. Right. Okay. Sure. So, in the meantime, going back to your Tibetan Buddhist teacher, does Buddhist philosophy reflect kind of a different perspective on copying or on imitation?
Yeah, it does. I don't think it's necessarily a unique perspective, but one thing that's very striking when you have a Buddhist practice is that mostly what you're doing is copying or imitating. And, you know, whether you're sitting and meditating on a cushion, whether you're saying a prayer, you're involved in very intense practices of copying. And what's interesting there is that it's believed that by imitation, by copying, you can overcome your bad habits, your suffering, and move towards a state called enlightenment. And that copying is a transformative practice in that sense.
Well, and couldn't you say that ironically, copying meditative practice is supposed to get you to the place where you experience this moment, this original moment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes I think in the Zen tradition, they call it original mind even, and that's a state kind of free of concepts in a way, and that concepts already are involved in copying, and that's the kind of paradox that Buddhism works with, that you have to be aware of the degree that you're immersed in structures and practices of copying in order to have some kind of freedom from those very things.
That's lovely. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. I think we got everything. Wow, this was just really fascinating. Thank you very, very much.
No, it's a pleasure. And thanks for your questions. Okay. It's good to think through this stuff again.
Okay. All right. Well, enjoy your non-spring day, and I hope spring arrives soon.
The snowflake copies outside.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thanks to Doug as well.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Cheers.